Right, so I'm going to talk about how detectable gravitational wave signals may arise from beyond the standard model physics. And I'm going to focus on an example based in the context of a string theory setup, although many of the things I'm going to say apply more broadly to theories with hidden sectors. So what I'm going to say is based on this work here that I wrote together with Sven Krippendorf and Jörn Martz-Russell, where we in fact argue that in the context of a string theory, you might in fact expect a lot of gravitational wave signals of wildly different frequencies, so something like a string soundscape. Right, so as you all know, gravitational waves are a prediction of GR. As a gravitational wave passes by, it causes matter to stretch and squeeze. And this relative amount of stretching and squeezing is what we call the strain of the gravitational wave, so H tidal, which is basically its amplitude. So for instance, for a point source of gravitational waves, this strain falls like 1 over the distance. So even though this may have been a very large number when the gravitational wave was first produced, when it reaches us here on Earth, it's a very tiny number. And so gravitational wave detectors are precisely designed to detect these tiny strains caused by an incoming gravitational wave. Right, so it's useful to think about the energy in gravitational radiation apart from on top of its strain. So in the weak field limit of GR, we can expand the metric as Minkowski plus a perturbation. And then it's possible to build an object, T mu nu, which basically we can identify with the stress energy tensor that corresponds to gravitational radiation. So here in this case, we're just writing it in some particular gauge, a transverse stress gauge. And the not component of this tensor will tell us about the energy density in gravitational waves. So if I normalize this energy density to the critical energy density of the universe today, then we find that this is case like frequency square of the wave times the strain square of the wave. So more frequency, more energy, more strain, more energy. Notice though crucially that for a fixed energy in gravitational waves, higher frequency waves produce smaller strains, which is the reason behind the fact that it's so hard experimentally to build detectors to build detectors in a sort of high frequency range, as we'll talk about more later. Right, so as you all know, this is a very exciting time for gravitational wave astronomy. LIGO has just detected gravitational waves directly for the first time, and in the coming future, many other detectors will do the same at different frequencies. So the astrophysical potential, and also the cosmological potential, of having gravitational wave detections at very different frequencies really cannot be overstated. And in the coming years, we'll learn a lot about a huge different population of astrophysical objects from this type of detections. Right, so this is a picture of the sensitivity of different gravitational wave experiments in terms of their strain as a function of frequency. So for instance, LIGO that operates in the frequency region between 10 and 10 to the 4 or so hertz has a peak sensitivity of around 10 to minus 22. LISA, which hopefully will be operating by 2028, operates between 10 to the minus 5 and a hertz. It has a peak sensitivity that is a little bit worse than LIGO, but not by very much. Then in the very low frequency range, between 10 to the minus 9 and 10 to the minus 6 hertz or so, there are the pulsar timing array detectors. The EPTA and SKA, which is an upcoming project. And then perhaps very far in the future, BBO will cover this frequency range between LISA and LIGO with some incredible sensitivity to the way down to 10 to the minus 24. Right, so this is roughly how well the detectors can do. And this is how some of the signals are expected to look like. So for instance, this red region here corresponds to the first signal seen by LIGO. Very famously. Other astrophysical sources of gravitational waves are binary and spiral systems of different types, relevant in both the LIGO region and the LISA region. Also supernova explosions, and in the very low frequency range, the main astrophysical sources are expected to be supermassive black hole binaries. Right, so this is how thin looks like in terms of the strain. In terms of the frequency, in terms of the energy in gravitational waves, this plot looks a little bit different. So as we said before, the energy density goes scales like frequency squared, strain squared. So things look like this. So here you see that even though LIGO had the best sensitivity, better than LISA or the PTAs, actually in terms of the energy density of gravitational waves, you can see it cannot do anywhere near as well. So this is the reason why in this part here, in this high frequency part here, there is a lack of sort of competitive experiments.
So for the Lisa curve, is there a reason to stop it at low frequency, or it goes really all the way?
All the way, which way?
Well, towards lower frequencies. But at some point it becomes weaker than its k, but is there...
I don't know, actually, that's a good point. Yeah, I don't know.
Because for Leibniz,
I don't know what it stops it at a low frequency.
It's like ground noise.
Right.
But for this, it's probably all the way.
So it probably goes all the way, but I'm not sure.
It's the stabilization noise of the thing, but it won't be expected because of that.
The first one's
already
supposed to stay stabilized or something.
Right. Yeah, so basically this is a picture of how the future is going to look like in a few years. So there will be a big range of different gravitational wave detectors telling us a lot of interesting things about what's out there. And so the question arises of whether we can also use these gravitational wave experiments to learn about beyond the standard model physics. So the answer is, of course, yes. And there are a few examples, although this is mostly unexplored territory by collider standards. So most famously, there is the possibility of a stochastic background of gravitational waves for some kind of inflationary dynamics. Also, there's the famous example of a first-order electric phase transition, perhaps motivated by baryogenesis. This will typically fall in the frequency region that LISA will explore. And then also, another example is the possibility of probing the existence of an axion, in particular a QCD action, using the phenomenon of black hole superradiance, which may be relevant sort of for LIGO. Right, so what I'm going to talk about here is a different example. So we talk about the possibility of a gravitational wave signal from vacuum decay taking place at zero temperature in a string theory motivated scenario. So what I'm going to say here, even though I'll focus on a particular example, many of the things I'm going to say apply more broadly to theories with hidden sectors that have metastable vacuum. And I will emphasize this many times during my talk, but notice that this is a process that is happening at zero temperature. So the vacuum decay process occurs purely by quantum mechanical tunneling. So this is not a thermal transition, which there are many things that are similar between these two processes. Many things are different. So we'll emphasize this during the talk. Right, so let me tell you a few things about string theory before we move forward. So supersymmetric string theory is consistently formulated in 10D. So there are six extra spatial dimensions that need to be compactified. So the typical compactification we're going to focus on looks something like this. So there is a bulk region which is largely unwarped. So the internal space is mostly flat. And then there are very many regions, these spikes here, of very high gravitational warpings. And these regions are typically called throats. If you're not familiar with this, you can think of a usual Randall-Sundrum throat, where you would have the UV brain in the region that stacks to the bulk, and then the infrared brain would correspond to the tip of one of these throats. Right, so why do these throats appear at all? So it turns out that string theory contains high-form generalizations of abelian gauge fields under field strengths. So like the F mu nu of electromagnetism, but just with more indices. And in the same way that you can have fluxes for the electric and magnetic fields, you can have fluxes for these other fields. And in fact, it turns out that these fluxes play a key role in string compactifications. Right, so just as in electromagnetism, these fluxes have an energy density. They gravitate, and it turns out that these regions of high gravitational warping that we call throats arise as a back reaction from these fluxes in the geometry. Right, so more in detail, what I mean is if we look at the sort of tip region of one of these throats, I can find out what the flux of these fields. So these fields I'm talking about are three-form fields, F3 and H3. If you're familiar with this, you'll know that these are the Ramon and Neversworth field strengths. Doesn't matter, they are just some three-form field strengths. So in a given throat, I can find the amount of flux of these fields that is going through a throat by integrating these three-form fields over a suitable three-dimensional surface, S3 cycle. And I find that, as usual, this flux is given by an integer number. There are two types of these fluxes. So I have two integers that tell me what the flux is on one of these throats. So these are integers that we call M and K. And as I was saying, it's due to these fluxes that these throats get very largely warped. And in particular, the warp factor at the tip of the throat is given by this expression. So it depends exponentially on what the amount of these fluxes is. It also depends on the string coupling, but you can see that it's very sensitive of what these fluxes are. Moreover, the amount of flux that goes through one of these throats doesn't have to be the same. So in principle, it would vary by a bit from throat to throat. But varying these fluxes by a little bit from throat to throat means that the warp factor is going to be very different from one throat to another. So you should think of this picture as very many throats in which the energy scale that is characteristic of the throat, which is given by this warp factor times the fundamental scale of the theory, which will be the string scale, is very different as you go from throat to throat. Okay? Right. So in this compactification, degrees of freedom can be localized pretty much anywhere. They could be the standard model, for instance, could be localized somewhere in the bulk. It could be localized in one of the throats. And similarly, you could have very many hidden sectors living in each one of these throats. So the picture you should have in mind is the standard model plus a lot of these throats with a lot of hidden sectors. And the characteristic energy scale of these hidden sectors in these throats is wildly different from one to the other. Right. So in particular, one example of a degree of freedom that may be localized in one of these compactifications are D-brains. So D-brains are non-perturbative objects that rise in string theory. They have D spatial dimensions. And in particular, there's one type of these objects called anti-D-brains. Which one can typically find living in these throats. And it just turns out that they tend to localize towards the tip, and they break supersymmetry locally on the throat. So a typical throat will have flux going through it, also a few anti-D3 brains on the tip. However, it was studied by the authors of this paper, Kashur et al, that a situation like this is typically unstable. So having a few anti-D3 brains, some units of flux typically corresponds to a metastable vacuum, and the system has another true vacuum where there are no anti-D3 brains, supersymmetry is preserved. And these guys studied these types of systems, and they found that actually you can understand the transition from this metastable vacuum to the true vacuum through this, so this effective Lagrangian. So this is an effective theory of only one scalar field, which is the psi. So you may notice there are some strange things about the scalar field. So in particular, it has a very weird-looking kinetic term that I will comment on later. But the most important thing is that the effective potential for this field is basically governed by a single parameter, which is P over M. So P is the number of anti-D3 brains that are at the tip. And M, if you remember, was the flux going through the throat of one of our fields. So P over M is basically the thing that is setting the shape of the potential. And in particular, the authors of this paper found that there is a critical value of this parameter, which is of around 8%. So if you have a value of P over M that is smaller than this, then the system develops this metastable vacuum. If it is larger, then there's only one true vacuum. So the situation is, say, classically unstable.
It's easy to see why it doesn't depend on the flux of the other
Well, so the thing is that the flux of the other field is not changing as you go from one vacuum to the other. So I don't think it's obvious to understand.
You're just looking at one particular type of this.
Sorry?
I think the fair one is that you're just looking at one particular type of this.
Yes, I mean, that's correct. And I mean, this is an effective description that only allows you to compute, it will only allow you to compute what the probability of the decaying is. You cannot do anything else with this. So it's very particular to this. To this question.
And the true vacuum is ABS or?
No, so the true vacuum is Minkowski. Supersymmetry is preserved there. I will show you in a minute. Yeah, so what I've said here in words basically corresponds to this picture. So this is effective potential for our field, P over M bigger than this 8% critical value. The system only has one true vacuum. As I make this parameter smaller, I develop this metastable vacuum. As it gets smaller and smaller, the metastable vacuum gets deeper and deeper. And as I said, so this the true vacuum, which occurs at psi, a value of psi, which is pi, preserves supersymmetry. The metastable vacuum breaks supersymmetry. So the authors, Katsu et al., they studied the systems in the case where P over N was very tiny, so it was very close to zero, and they found that the lifetime of this metastable vacuum was much larger than the age of the universe. However, so we're going to study the system in the regime where this parameter is very close to the critical value. So just below the critical value, and we parameterize how much below by this parameter delta that we take to be between, you know, zero and something that's much smaller than one. So in this regime, we'll find that the lifetime of this false vacuum is cosmologically relevant, meaning that it could have decayed sometime after inflation and before BBM. And we'll ask the question of whether this process of vacuum decay could generate the strong enough gravitational waves for us to see. Right. OK, so before I move forward, there are a few assumptions I need to make. So we will assume that this is a picture we're looking at once inflation is finished. So we will assume that after inflation, at least there's one of these throats that finds itself in this type of metastable vacuum. We will assume that after inflation, the standard model sector is being reheated to high enough temperatures so that BBN will proceed sort of in the standard way. But we will assume, and this is an assumption, that this hidden sector is not reheated very much. So typically, if the standard model is living in some throat, and this other hidden sector is living in some other very far away kind of throat, the interactions between these two sectors may be just gravitational. So if the standard model gets reheated, there's no reason to believe this thing is reheated to the same degree. So just for simplicity, we'll focus on the case where the temperature of this hidden sector is much smaller than any other energy scale of interest. So a zero temperature treatment is sufficient. And so the decay will only occur through quantum mechanical tunneling.
So quantitatively, that means this temperature is much smaller than the scale of KKa masses?
Right, solid? Yes. So we assume it's much smaller than anything that's relevant. I mean, in a more general case, you know, this could be somewhere in the middle. And so the real process could be like some mix of quantum mechanical tunneling plus thermal. But just for simplicity, we'll still do this case first. Right, and then a further assumption we'll make is that, so there are two things going on in this case. So on the one hand, we have the energy density of the false vacuum. On the other hand, we also have the energy density of the thermal plasma. So the total will be a sum of both. And then we will assume that the ratio of vacuum energy density to radiation energy density is always smaller than one for all temperatures involved.
So we're thinking of this rho vacuum as the cosmological concept?
No, this is just the vacuum energy density of this metastable vacuum. It's nothing else. I mean, the reason you need to be this number to be smaller than one is that if not, there will be a temperature where this rho vacuum energy density starts to dominate, and then you'll have like a second period of inflation. You want the vacuum to decay fast enough, and in a region where the raw vacuum never dominates over the thermal part. I hope that makes sense. Right. So just to give you a picture of what's happening. So the decay rate of this metastable vacuum per unit volume, which here I call a gamma, is a quantity that doesn't depend on temperature. It only depends on what the details of the throat are. However, the probability of nucleating a bubble of true vacuum per Hubble volume in a Hubble time is given by this ratio, so gamma over Hubble to the fourth. And Hubble is just given by the usual expression. So Hubble is a quantity that, as the temperature drops, is also dropping. So as the temperature drops, this ratio is getting bigger. So in particular, once inflation ends, at very high temperatures, this probability is a very small number. So the system remains in its metastable vacuum. There will be some temperature that we call the nucleation temperature, where this quantity becomes close to one, where on average you would expect to have one bubble of true vacuum per Hubble volume. And then that's around the temperature at which this transition happens. But yeah, so basically the important thing here is that this transition is basically driven by the temperature dropping and Hubble getting smaller. So this is different from what happens, for instance, in the case of a thermal phase transition, where gamma there is also depending strongly on temperature. This will be important later, as I point out. But anyway, this is the picture you should have in mind. What I've just said is basically summarizing this picture. So there will be some temperature where you start nucleating bubbles. These bubbles will start expanding at the speed of light very quickly. While they are expanding, basically the bubbles are spherically symmetric. So spherically symmetric, they won't be emitting gravitational waves, modulos and caveats that we'll talk about later. But then at some point they collide, and then most of the gravitational wave radiation emitted will happen when these guys collide. Okay.
So in the thermal phase transition, the seeds for this bubble nucleation are thermal fluctuations.
Yes.
And what are those?
The seeds
for the false quantum, do they sort of depend on how this modulus couples to matter or not?
Well, in this case, it's purely quantum fluctuations. This is the usual picture of quantum mechanical tunneling. Yes, so it's purely this in the usual way.
Saying that quantum decay doesn't depend.
Yeah, so gamma, as I said before, doesn't depend at all. It depends strictly only on the details of the throat. If there is some coupling, you know, bigger than what I've just said, between this sector and the standard model, then this will be a bit different. But we're studying this case that is the simplest first. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand.
Right. So yeah, I've told you that, you know, we have this vacuum decay rate that doesn't depend on temperature. So how do we compute this? So the way to find out the rate of decay of a metastable vacuum is to ask about what's this energy. So one can try to compute the expectation value of this operator. So H hat is just the Hamiltonian operator, tau is real. And we want to find the expectation value of this operator in the false vacuum. So in the limit when tau is very large, the leading term here will be something like this, and where E false vacuum will be what we think is the energy of the false vacuum. One way to compute this is to use the usual Euclidean path integral formulation approach, where here we're summing over all paths that start and end in the false vacuum. And of course, this right-hand side here will be dominated by those field configurations that extremize the action. So we are looking for field configurations that satisfy this equation. Remember, this is Euclidean action, so this is an O4 symmetric equation. Depends only on this Euclidean coordinate R. Also, the solution only depends on this coordinate, and is subject to these boundary conditions. So just very far. So for R goes to infinity, the value of the field needs to be equal to the false vacuum value. So for instance, if you have a potential with just one minimum, you will find that the only solution to this equation is psi equals psi false vacuum. So there's only one solution, which is the trivial solution. You substitute things in, and you find that this energy here is a real number because this state is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian and so on. It's very easy. However, if you have a potential that is non-trivial, so for instance has two vacua, there's one further solution to this equation, which is non-trivial. And this is what people typically call the bound solution. In our case, this equation looks something like this. And as I said before, this bound solution is the one non-trivial field configuration that extremizes the Euclidean action. It contributes to what the energy of the false vacuum is in this way. So n here is some number that is not very important. So it depends exponentially on what the value of the Euclidean action is at the bounds. And then it has this factor here of the square root of the determinant of this operator, which is the second variational derivative of the action at the bounds. And it's crucial that, as was studied by Coleman in this paper a long time ago, this bounds configuration has a property which is this operator evaluated at the bounds has one negative eigenvalue. So when I take the square root of this, I get a factor of I. So I'm trying to compute an energy, and I'm finding that there's a factor of I there. which is telling you that you can interpret this quantity as a decay rate, right? So from here, you can find what the decay rate is. So the decay rate per unit volume will look, you can readily find this, and it looks something like this. So it depends exponentially on what the Euclidean action evaluated at the bounds is, minus what it is at the force vacuum. And then there is a mass fed to the force in front that basically depends on what this determinant is, but it's basically set by the curvature scale of the potential at the barrier. All right? Okay. So this bound solution, apart from telling you what the probability of decay is, it also sets how the bubble looks like when it's nucleated. So there I said it sets the t equals zero boundary condition. By t equals zero, I mean the time at which the bubble is nucleated. And the later evolution of the bubble is given by analytically continuing what this bounce is. Right, so how does this bounce look like? So in general, this question you cannot answer just by looking at the potential. It requires you numerically computing this. However, there's one limiting case that is useful to think about, which is the thin wall case. So in the case where you have a potential with two vacua that are very, very close in energies, so the difference in energy densities between these two vacua compared to the barrier that separates them is much smaller than one. In this case, you get what is called a thin wall bounce. So a thin wall bounce means that at the center of the bounce, the field achieves its value in the true vacuum. It stays with this value up to some distance, which we call the sort of critical radius of the bounce. Then very quickly, over a very small distance, it changes to the value in the false vacuum. So the definition of a thin wall bounce is that this distance over which the field is changing is much smaller compared to the critical radius. So this is exactly how the bubble looks like at the moment it gets nucleated. So you should think it looks something like this. It's some spherical thing. At the center, the field has its true vacuum. Then there is some very thin region where the field is changing, and outside, the field has its false vacuum value. Right.
So in the thermal case, you can consider the order of the Bayesian situation. In the thermal Bayesian situation, you can consider the order of the Bayesian situation, and you do need stronger Bayesian situation to have the. So this is a similar.
Yeah, so actually this is one of the things in which these two pictures are similar. So yeah, so in the thermal case, you can also have potentials of this like this, and then you will also find, you know, a thin wall solution in this case, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the difference is that, you know, in the thermal case the potential is also changing with temperature. Right. In the general case, however, finding what the bounce looks like and, you know, how this means how the bubble when it's nucleated looks like is not possible to say by just looking at the potential. So if you have a potential that looks, you know, there's nothing special about it, you just don't know how this guy looks like. You don't know whether the field is changing over a wide range. You don't know even what the value of the field is inside. It's not necessarily equal to the true vacuum. So this requires you computing it. Yeah, but thick wall precisely means you know nothing, right?
No. But when the minimum becomes close to maximum, then basically only a few terms in the potential matter.
Right.
There's no analytic solution there.
Well, in some cases, that's right. That's right. Well, in our case, we find, in fact, that, you know, our bounces look sort of thick wall, like thick wall bounce, in the sense that the distance over which the field is changing its value is actually similar compared to what the radius of this thing is. So this is the value of psi, the bounds as a function of this O4 symmetric coordinate R. And here I'm just multiplying by some factor to make everything dimensionless, but that's not important. So you might remember that I said that the true vacuum is for a value of psi, which is pi. And you can already see that the value of psi at the center of the bounds is actually much below pi. It only evolves there later as the bubble expands. But anyway, this is how our bounces look like. So this is how the bubbles look like when they are nucleated.
This is the Spanish curve kinetic term?
No, actually, so the kinetic term, the strange looking kinetic term doesn't play a role here. And the reason is precisely that for the values of delta we're focusing on, the bounce always look, it's actually this derivative here is very small. So actually all this all these terms that in principle look like an infinitely many series of derivative terms actually don't matter for the nucleation.
I see, because, yeah, no, in a similar situation, because essentially there are some singular looping configurations, but this loop has geometric meaning.
Yeah.
So there are some other solutions. In very similar situations, we found that when you approach the SIG quality limit, the minimum becomes close to maximum.
Right.
And actually, a different solution dominates, which kind of looks singular in the initial Poisson image, but it's not singular generally. We can discuss it.
Yeah, perhaps we should discuss this. I mean, in our case, we find that in this for these values of delta, this the strange nature of the kinetic terms doesn't mind, and we think that as you make delta bigger, then it will kick in. But yeah, we can talk.
Can you remind what delta is?
Yeah, so delta. So I was saying that we're taking the value of this P over M parameter, which is equal to P over M critical times 1 minus delta. So delta is sort of the fractional deviation from the critical situation.
Because that's exactly the region where we found. Well, it's a slightly different model, but very similar. Where we found that actually differences, like solutions which are not obvious, start dominating.
Okay. Well, maybe we should talk about that. Yeah.
Which
thing are you referring to? Which thing of yours were you referring to? Just,
sorry?
Which work is this you're talking about?
Well, we had a paper with Alvin and Lawrence.
Okay. Well, so this is what we find regarding the bounds. And this is what we find for our probability of decay. So as I said before, this decay rate per unit volume loose. Like some mass scale to the fourth times e to the minus b. So for the Euclidean action evaluated at the bounds, we find an expression like this, which basically depends on what the string coupling is. It depends on the units of this flux. And it also depends on this parameter delta. And this is a computation that we do numerically. But notice that it depends very strongly on what these fluxes are, for instance. I mean, here we take the fluxes to be 100 because this is a typical value. But if you take something that is a bit different, then this it will change the answers. And then for the mass scale in front, we find that it's basically given by this expression. So there is some numerical factor. Then, as you might expect, this is given by the characteristic energy scale of the throat, and then also depends on delta. So notice that here, as delta becomes smaller, which is the limit of when the barrier is disappearing, this quantity becomes smaller. And the whole thing, gamma, becomes bigger, as you might expect. Right, so that's about how these things are formed. So as I said before, once this ratio, this probability of nucleation becomes of order one, you start nucleating on average one bubble of true vacuum per Hubble volume. And they are approximately, when they are nucleated, they are approximately spherical and at rest. Moreover, we find in the parameter regime we're working on, we find that their critical radius it's very, very tiny compared to a Hubble length. So they pretty much look point-like at the time. And then these bubbles start expanding very quickly. And their walls quickly reach relativistic velocities very close to C. Right, so basically at this point, you need to ask yourself, how does this transition complete? So as I said before, as the temperature is dropping, this probability is growing. So gamma over h to the 4 is growing. So there are two things, roughly speaking, that could happen. One is that gamma over h to the 4 is growing so quickly that you generate a lot of bubbles, and then the transition completes by you having a lot of the small bubbles colliding with each other. Another possibility is gamma over h to the 4 is not growing so quickly, and what happens is that the transition completes by only a few large bubbles colliding with each other. So in our case, because gamma is independent of temperature, we think that the situation is this one. So we think the transition completes by a few bubbles growing very much and colliding with each other, which is different from what you would expect in the thermal case, where typically you nucleate a lot of them, and you have a large number of very small bubbles. But this is not our case. And so we expect the transition to complete. So the time the transition takes to complete, we expect will be of the order that these bubbles take to grow and collide with each other. And we find that this is typically of order a Hubble time. But with time, the temperature at the time these guys collide is falling from what it was at the nucleation time by a factor of 60%, basically. Right, so this is basically what I said before. At the time our bubbles collide, their walls are expanding basically with relativistic velocity, so very close to one. And so they have a very large gamma factor. So numerically, we find that the gamma factor of these bubble walls is of order 10 to the 4. And this is relevant because I said before that at nucleation, our bubbles look very thick wall. So there is a thickness of the wall that is comparable to the radius. But as these things are expanding, this wall thickness is getting Lorentz contracted. So by the time they collide, they're very thin. So the assumption that most of the energy density is concentrated on the walls is will be a good assumption. Right. So before we go forward, there are a few differences with the sort of thermal first transition case that I want to emphasize. So in our case, I've said that our bubble walls reach ultra-relativistic velocities very fast. However, in the case of a thermal phase transition, you typically have bubble walls that are also interacting with the thermal plasma that is sitting outside the wall. And this typically amounts to a friction term that somehow slows this wall. So it depends on the setup, but basically bubble wall velocities between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 1 are most common in the sort of thermal case. So they very rarely reach relativistic velocities. Also, as I said before, the probability of nucleating a bubble per Hubble volume, per Hubble time, grows very slowly as the temperature drops. It only grows polynomially because Hubble depends on temperature. In the thermal case, gamma depends exponentially on the temperature. So for instance, in our case, we expect the duration of the transition to take a very long time. In the thermal case, because you're nucleating so many bubbles so quickly, this actually typically takes to complete an amount of time that is much, much smaller than a Hubble time at the time.
Not necessarily, right? I mean, the bubbles can release energy into the plasma and heat it up and bring you back.
Yes, yes. So modulo these things. Yeah, if everything, yeah, absolutely. That could also happen. In the most standard case, that's not necessarily, yeah, normally that's not what you find.
It's still very different.
Yeah, and then there's one important difference between the two cases, which is the main source of gravitational wave production in our case is just the bubbles colliding with each other. In the case of a thermal phase transition where there is some thermal plasma, there are actually other sources of gravitational waves that typically dominate over the bubble wall collision one, which is to do with turbulence in the plasma, sound waves, and so on and so forth. There's a whole lot of sort of very complicated physics here. And as I'll say later, so the gravitational wave signal actually looks rather different. Right, so what happens is, at the time this transition is taking place, there are a lot of bubbles colliding with each other in different Hubble volumes. So what we see today is a stochastic background of gravitational waves. The frequency peak of this gravitational wave signal is going to be given by what the size of these bubbles are when they are colliding, and then redshifting to what the frequency is today. It can be written in this way. So here we're already setting this is a very cumbersome way of writing it, but it emphasizes that, in our case, so T star is the duration of the transition. This is an order one number. And the values of temperature here are mostly just set by you redshifting to what the frequency is today. However, notice that this collision temperature that plays a role here, and you know the same as with the nucleation temperature, is very sensitive to the details of what this throat sector is.
So how low can you push your TC to be?
How low? So in principle, this could be anything between, after inflation and before BBN.
Oh.
Something like this.
Why BBN is a problem? Because you have subdominant contributions.
Well, I mean, you could go farther than that, but just to be, just in order for BBN to, just happen undisrupted, we're just putting a bound here.
It's not clear that BBN will be disrupted because you put subdominant energy.
But BBN is very sensitive to energy injection at the time, so it's not clear to us that you would not mess up.
Very sensitive. It's sensitive to if you put in some significant fraction, like say 10% or something.
Right.
This is like adding an effective of BBN. Right?
If you're below 1%, you never see.
It's presumably similar to the effective balance, in which case, if you're below that, you won't see it.
Agreed.
If you stay below 1%, you can have
sure. Gravitational decoupled insect can do what it likes as long as it's low energy
density. I mean, we're putting ourselves this bound because we want to take ratios of this energy density to the energy density in the plasma, perhaps, or the way up to 1. And in that case, it's a problem. Of course, this is like 10 to minus 3, there's no problem, but just to be safe. So basically, this is a picture of how the frequency peak of the gravitational wave signal looks like as a function of the Bohr factor at the tip of the throat. So basically, I mean, all this, as we saw before, the Bohr factor is a quantity that depends exponentially on what these fluxes are. So even though these numbers might seem very small, they are all perfectly reasonable numbers for Bohr factors at the tip of these throats. And then you can see that actually the frequencies that are possible here are relevant. I mean, they are basically covered by all these different types of experiments.
So why is Bohr factor which matters? So it's Bohr factor with respect to what? With respect to, because we are also living in some world, there is also our work, but we just don't understand why Bohr factor matters.
Well, so here basically we're put. I mean, notice that I'm also choosing some values of the volume of the compactification.
Right.
So I'm choosing some factor of the volume, which means I'm fixing what the string scale is. And by doing this as a function of the Bohr factor, I'm basically doing it as a function of what the characteristic energy scale of the throat is. So, and remember that my gamma, so this the K rate, it depends on this mass scale to the fourth. So it's just basically setting what gamma is. I mean, we just thought it was like a useful parameter to plot this against.
If I think about this row, there's some strongly coupled pH sector that's like more practically determines lambda QCD of the pH sector, right? So that's the energy.
Right. Yes. I mean, it's crucial that we are fixing also some volume in these cases. So this tells you what M string is and so on and so forth. Right, so basically, you see here that for smaller values of delta, so as the system is closer and closer to the critical situation, the frequency becomes higher. And you can understand this because, as I said before, as delta is smaller, this barrier is also smaller, which means that you only need to decrease the temperature a little bit for your nucleation probability to become order one. Here we see that as we choose the volume of this compactification larger, the frequency also goes towards the smaller values. And you can understand this precisely because then, as the volume is bigger, the characteristic energy scale is going to be smaller. And then you need to draw the temperature a lot more for the bubbles to start nucleating. But yeah, basically, the important thing in this plot is that the possibility of frequency range, it basically, you know, could be relevant for frequencies all the way from 10 to minus 9 to sort of 10 to 7 hertz. So an interesting frequency range with sort of realistic assumptions for what these systems may look like. I haven't said this, but here, as I said before, we're setting the fluxes to be so for order 100. Right. Yeah, so and all that is required for this picture is that there is at least one throat that after inflation finds itself in one of these metastable vacuum with delta in a suitable range, which of course is not guaranteed, but doesn't seem unreasonable either. Although it's very hard to make statistical statements in any well-defined way.
There's no any coupling, you don't need any coupling to the visible sector at all.
Well, I mean, you just assume the minimal thing is that they talk gravitationally. If there are other things going on, then things will be a bit different, but we haven't looked at that.
So how many throats do you expect?
So how do you answer that question? I mean, what I'm saying here is that if you have one that's in the metastable vacuum and has a value of delta in this regime, then you will see this. In a statistical sense, how many throats you expect in a compact, I don't even know how to answer this question. In a well-defined sort of statistical sense.
Or like in examples.
I mean, what's the measure of one of these given throats? I don't know. I mean, I don't think anybody knows, really. And you certainly expect some, but you know what the sum is. I mean, measures in the string landscape, I don't know.
Do produce also point out the cycle?
Sorry?
Do produce point out
yeah, so
in the collisions, right? Because you have a very steep profile of the walls, right? Even if size massive, you can still produce it in the immediate.
Yes, so the energy, I mean, there's, So the amount of energy that goes into gravitational waves is actually much smaller than the total energy you have available. So you need to ask yourself what happens to the rest. And one possibility is you produce these fields, which in the absence of supersymmetry breaking are massless. So you could produce a lot of dark radiation there. We computed how much you could produce, and it seems it was something like a delta N effective of 0.3 or so for the scenarios we look at. Other possibilities are, you know, if you had some non-trivial hidden sector in this throat, N effective being like around 0.3. I mean, for
so
the... Well, this was if you were releasing all your energy density into dark radiation.
You should probably not do more than 0.5.
Well, yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, you don't know really how much goes into it. And also depends on the spectrum of states in this hidden sector. If there is some other massive state you could produce, perhaps you would produce those too. I mean, this depends very much on the sort of the details. So we looked at a few possibilities just to make sure it was safe. But you cannot say a lot more. Right, so that was in terms of the frequency, in terms of the strength. So the strength of the signal is given by an expression like this. And here, I'm already writing this, setting the velocity of the walls equals 1. So and in our case, this is typically much stronger than what you find for a thermal transition, because, as I said before, the duration of our transition is expected to be much bigger. So this is another 1 number. And also because V is equals 1 at the time these guys collide. And when it's not equals 1, this expression can be suppressed by at least a factor of V cubed, which is a big suppression if your V is over there 0.1 or so. Right, so this picture is, so this is a plot of how these signals are expected to look like. So I'm just choosing some peak frequencies for illustration. The peak would be really anywhere. And we're plotting only the signal that would arise from a standard bubble walls colliding, as people have found by numerical simulations. And I'm plotting this, so this is as a function of this parameter, so alpha at collision, which is the ratio of this vacuum energy density to the energy density in the plasma at the collision time. So the blue curves are drawn for when this thing is equals 1, which is the, in principle, maximal case. As alpha at collision gets smaller, then obviously the strength of the signal also gets smaller, but even for sort of a smallish values of alpha, this signal may be within the observable region. Right. So I want to emphasize here that we're using the shape of the gravitational wave signal mostly for illustration. We believe that the peak of the signal, we basically believe what it is. This high frequency part of the signal, we're pretty confident it doesn't look like this. But we don't really know how it looks like. So you might remember from my previous slide that this field has a very weird-looking kinetic term. And we think that this will affect how this frequency part will look like. So this high frequency part of the signal really depends on the details of the underlying model. And so we believe that this will make a difference. But it's still a work in progress. Something that in the last few minutes I'll talk about, which I think is also very interesting, is related to this sort of high frequency behavior of these guys. So I said before that when you nucleate these bubbles, they are typically spherical. This is only partially true. The bounce is a spherical configuration, but it's only one of the infinitely many you are summing over. So actually what really happens is that you have a bunch of quantum fluctuations on top of this bounce. And really this is more what the bubble is supposed to look like. And sort of the typical non-sphericity and the typical relative velocities of the different points on this on the wall of the bubble, their sizes, their relative sizes are given by this. So this is, if you remember, is the value of the Euclidean action evaluated at the bounds. For the values of fluxes and so on we were taking, this was a number that was around 30-ish. So 1 over 30 to the 1/3 is roughly something that is kind of 30%, right? So a 30% fluctuation is not what you would call a very small fluctuation. And it turns out that, you know, these fluctuations introduce an energy scale in the system, which is transverse to the direction of propagation of the bubble walls. So unlike what happens with the thickness of the wall, that it gets Lorentz contracted as the bubbles expand, this other length scale is not getting Lorentz contracted as the bubbles are expanding. So how these fluctuations evolve as the bubble expands is actually not very, it's in general not known. There are some simplified studies, but it's actually not known how they look like when they get fluctuated or how they evolve later. But this could be relevant because if for some reason these guys were still sort of largish as the bubble is expanding, then the statement that you are not generating gravitational waves as the bubbles expand will no longer be true. If the situation is deviated from sphericity enough. And here is where we might think that this funny looking in kinetic terms may play a role in how these fluctuations evolve.
But if there are fluctuations, they are not small, right? So the bubble by itself will
reduce
the gravitational
waves. So there are some people that have done studies of these in the sort of standard, you know, one scalar field, normal looking scalar field case. They find that, so basically you can understand these modes, these fluctuations, by doing some expansion in spherical harmonics, as you would expect. So they find that there are some modes that, depending on their initial velocities, some modes quickly die away, and there are some modes that grow, and then they freeze, and then, because they freeze, but the bubble is still expanding, the relative size gets smaller. But the question is whether these guys freeze out before they reach sort of the nonlinear regime or not. So that's where we might think it might be interesting. And it's a little bit complicated, but so we're trying to make analytical progress on that front. So that could be interesting. We also think, you know, this could play a role as well on the shape of the high frequency part of the gravitational wave signal. And also perhaps on the possibility of producing black holes when these guys are colliding, which is a very hard problem to make. Admittedly, a very hard problem to make progress on, but very exciting. So we're thinking about these things. Right. Okay, so just to wrap up, I mean, it's totally obvious that gravitational wave experiments will play a key role in our understanding of physics in the next few decades. They will complement the information we get, or we don't get, I don't know, from particle colliders or dark matter experiments. In particular, in the case of string theory, you know, we've explored one case of a metastable vacuum decaying. There are actually many examples in string theory of metastable vacuum. So perhaps this is more a general feature of string theory. But in any case, this provides yet another example of how this type of experiments might help us probe up all the way up to the highest energy scales. Right, thank you.
Things about this quadratically, okay, some gauge sector, which there's some first order phase transition there, but it has small energy scale compared to M plus. So like why would there be black holes produced as a result of the space transition?
Well, I mean, so the fact that you can produce black holes from bubble collisions, I mean, this has been known for a long time, right? So it's just due to the fact that if you have all your energy, say, localized on the walls, there's a huge amount of energy density when these things are colliding that gets released.
Well, but it's not But exactly, it's all flat space. Gravity, this is flat space timeline, right? So you are in the region when the gravitational backreaction is not very small. It's small, right? So, and then, well, it's like any other, like it's still theoretic phase transition. Okay, there are some bubbles being produced, but why?
I think with the base point, you just have a very large over density. You get a very strong energy density perturbation.
I mean, it's mostly the fact.
If it's exactly symmetric, then yeah, you can argue that there's not a big problem, but it seems to break the symmetry. You got a lot of energy density in a small space.
Well, what means what?
I mean, I think the key part.
You should deal with zero, right? You should find
zero. There is certainly Planck variations that.
But I mean, it's mostly the fact that you have this energy density localized in a very small part. I mean, if everything is localized in the very thin region, which is the bubble wall, when these guys are colliding, there's a huge amount of energy density there, right?
So in the quantum phase transition, you don't thermalize, so everything is stored in the bubble. There.
Yes.
Oh.
I mean, until they collide.
What I understand Sergei's comment was that the main case is transverse thickness on that wall.
Yeah.
Regulated by the scale factor.
So that phase transition is not different from any other phase transition. So why kind of
It is ultra relativistic.
Yeah, right.
So you get some benefit from that.
But I mean, this is all. So all I'm saying here about the primordial black holes from bubble collisions is not different to, you know, the case. I mean, the things people studied in sort of, you know, a long time ago when they were thinking about inflation and so on.
Yeah.
The only point is that perhaps these other fluctuations may make a difference. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how.
Any other questions?
Well,
so if I remember correctly, so the CDL is described a bubble nucleus in a particular space. But now you are talking about bubble nucleation in a FRW inverse.
Right.
So does that make any difference?
So what you're saying is that, you know, we're using the sort of Coleman-Kallan formalism to compute the nucleation rate. This is true because, you know, we're not in a vacuum dominated universe. I mean, the fact that there is the universe is radiation dominated means that, you know, what we're doing is right. I mean, it's different. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's how, I mean, we have this CDL incident because the background has the dipole ball symmetry in the nucleation space.
Yes.
That's why this bound solution minimum applies the actions. But if you have a FRW,
well, no, so basically, when you compute the bounds, this is all for symmetric just by looking at how the Euclidean action looks like. When you want to look at actually, you know, physically what this means, as I said, it means, you know, the bounds is really setting what the bubble is at the time it gets nucleated. This all for symmetry really translates into Lorentz invariance by analytically continuing the bounds equation. Does that make sense?
I think the point is that the bubble is very small compared to the sun.
Oh yeah, at the moment it gets nucleated, it's very small compared to,
that's
that's right. Yeah, that's very important.
Okay. And another question is, so in your setup, you consider this extra dimension, and I'm just wondering, could the gravitational wave leak to that extra dimension? Could leak to the extra dimension, because you have, although it's compact, but
The extra dimension being the compactified?
Yeah.
I don't know, perhaps. I mean, we don't think so because, I mean, for this sort of, I mean, we're, yeah. I mean, the things could happen, but, I mean, we're still talking about work factors that are very small and much smaller than the string scale. So I don't think that would be.
But if you look at the space time on the bubble wall, then
From
the outside of the bubble to the interior of the bubble, you have to cross some region. And I'm not sure if that region is scale compact.
I'm not sure I understand your question. I mean, we can talk about it more, right? Yeah.
Well, okay. So I didn't want to really talk to like, there are anywhere, happy to discuss this after you go. But there, it seems to me there are two big problems with this problem. One is, I would say, the flux vacuum necessarily requires sort of some negative energy in orient poles in particular. And we know these are non-perturbatively unstable.
Right.
So I would say those things don't make sense as solutions in string theory. I don't know what your point of view is.
Well, so not being a string theorist, first of all, we rely on the study that Kaschuler et al. Did of these systems when they have a few anti-dithier brains on the tip, and the description of how you could compute sort of, you know, the transition probability from this sort of metastable vacuum to the true vacuum.
Yeah.
I cannot give you an opinion on whether I think the existence of this this metastable vacuum is sensible or not. You may know better. So.
Well, okay. I'll say that later on. And second issue is it's more well, it's a more general thing beyond just string theory. That is, if we trace back the history of the universe far enough, we get to a temperature. I don't know what happens at the Planck scale, but certainly we get it above a temperature above this barrier. And so, assuming that we end inflation or even start inflation for that matter in one of these metastable vacuums, it seems to me rather assuming like you know. You just had a hurricane come through your house and you end up with a pencil balanced on its tip. Well, it's ludicrous to me. Do you have an argument on this?
Well, so.
Well, if the pencil took the age of the universe to Popper, then that's not
what?
So. If the pencil is saved enough, takes the age of the universe to Popper, that's not so unreasonable.
Takes the age of the universe to
these are very long lifetime bracket.
No.
The point is, we had a temperature well above the barrier.
That's the most questions can be just instead of thinking about throw, think about gauge sector, which is metastable and decoupled to us. It's completely equivalent quadratically.
Yeah.
And then there's no problem with both questions, right? So that sector is not coupled to us directly, so it's
no, I mean, everything is coupled at that point.
But gravitationally.
Your temperature is way above all that.
Who's
in the sun
of all because I know that it's a singularity difference. Because we know that up at the Planck scale we don't know what happened. But we certainly got new temperatures that got close to that. So
I think it's fine to assume that inflation ends at a low enough temperature that it's
not.
If inflation scale is low enough,
then no. But how did you get that? It seems like it's a ridiculous fine tuning, it seems to me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know how to answer that question.
An argument as to why this isn't ridiculous, I'd love to hear it.
Because the inflation that we've observed is well below the Planck scale. There's no way we're planking energy densities.
Yes.
I mean, we've already ruled that out, so I don't know.
No,
this would be perfectly consistent with even
that doesn't answer the question remotely. I mean, that's saying, yes, so the real world doesn't act like that. Yes, I agree, the real world doesn't act like that. So then you have two possible conclusions. Either somehow there's some reasonable mechanism to do this thing, or this is the wrong mechanism.
Well, I mean, there are only two assumptions we're making here, right? Which is, there are all these hidden sectors in these roads. To us, it doesn't seem unreasonable to think that inflation reheats us preferentially to some other sectors. I mean, it doesn't seem unreasonable, in particular if these guys, are only interacting gravitationally. And second, in a picture where you have a lot of these roads, then I don't see what's weird about having one of these, with a number of fluxes and so on that could be in one of these metastable states.
If you were somehow, if you had this picture, you somehow had picked, the vacuum out of a box by hand, okay, that sounds real, but that's not what really happened. But we don't seem to be getting anywhere.
Okay. Well, that's thank you, Spelagan.